Welcome to howtofinancemoney.com podcast. I am your host, CF. Now, first and foremost, please pardon my Malaysian accent and pronunciation, as English is really not my mother tongue. You might cringe a bit when I speak, so I promise I'll only speak short sentences for the rest of the podcast interview. But first, bear with me with a short introduction of my very special guest today. His name is Andrew Hallam, and he is the author of the highly successful bestseller, Millionaire Teacher, The 9 Rules of Wealth You Should Have Learned in School, which outline his spending and investment philosophy. This is probably the only finance book which does its job not only to educate, but also to entertain. For your information, the Millionaire Teacher book was ranked number 1 at Amazon's US personal finance book category in November 2011. Now, listen to this. Andrew is not a corporate banker, he is not a lawyer, and he's definitely not a businessman. He is a high school teacher in Singapore. I wish my high school teacher taught me about things like compounding interest and investing, because these things are certainly more practical than solving complex algebra, quadratic equations, or even trigonometry. Andrew has walked the walk when his investment portfolio grew over $1 million by the time he was just 38. There are some really great money lessons we could all learn from him. Obviously, if assuming, say, I were a fresh college grad, I just started out as an engineer, and then I met you. Okay, what money advice would you give me to emulate your investing success?
Well, the first thing is to ensure that you think for yourself and you have some discipline, because one of the challenges that a college graduate will face is that he or she will end up with, hopefully, with a job and a reasonable salary, and he or she, if this was you in this case, you would have peers who would start spending money.
Right.
And the problem is that the things that they would actually go on to purchase would be depreciating assets for the most part. So they'd say, well, I've got the salary, now it's time to get a car. And they may end up spending far more for their car than they really ought to, instead of buying a secondhand car. Many of them would go off and buy a new car, not recognizing that the difference between the new and the secondhand car, it's not just, you know, maybe 5 or 8 or 10 or 15,000 ringgit. It's more than that. It's the difference in terms of what opportunity is given up by spending that extra 5, 10, or 15,000 ringgit. So if that money were actually invested from such a young age, as a new college graduate could, that money would grow to probably $1 million ringgit at the end of the day. So by the time that person is sort of 50 years old, the difference between those two cars is really about $1 million ringgit difference. So that's the first thing I would suggest, is to watch their spending and not necessarily do what the people around them are doing. We often get trapped into kind of keeping up. In the States, they've got that expression of keeping up with the Joneses.
Right.
And Mr. and Mrs. Jones, they really aren't that smart.
Financially, yeah?
Financially, exactly. And that's the case with a lot of people. We can be, and I've met, and I'm sure you have, met some extremely bright people, came out of super Ivy League colleges, great salaries, but metaphorically speaking, if they have their bucket and they're holding it under a tap of gushing water, and the water is their income, they've got these fist-sized holes at the bottom of their bucket because they're spending too much money. So the second thing, of course, is to start investing as early as you can, because for every 5 or 6 years that you delay, you end up having to invest twice as much as somebody who started 5 or 6 years before you to end up with the same kind of retirement nest egg.
Right.
because money compounds, and it's very, very powerful, as Einstein suggests, that it's more powerful than the splitting of the atom. And he calls it the eighth wonder of the world. So
yes,
the way it can compound over time is a fabulous thing.
Mm.
I think that the third thing I would tell them
is
that when they start investing, one of the things many people do is they actually hope that their investments rise in value. We know that the investments will eventually rise in value. One of the nice things is, or one of the smart things, is to not get too carried away if it does, and not get too despondent if it doesn't. If it doesn't rise in value, say you're investing in the world's stock markets, the longer it stays in a dormant phase, the better. Because as an investor, you're accumulating assets in businesses. And those businesses, as an aggregate, are actually making more and more money.
Mm.
The companies themselves. If the stock price doesn't go along with that, that is actually a really great thing. The longer you can end up taking advantage of that lag, the better. So for a young person, cheap or dropping stock markets or stagnating stock markets are actually better than rising stock markets.
So you need to embrace it.
Absolutely embrace it. I love it when markets fall, because I'm an accumulator. So I'm actually purchasing assets as an investor because I'm only 41. And so I'm not at any time soon going to sit around and play golf all day and start spending my retirement portfolio. I still really enjoy my job. And so for me, when the markets fall, I absolutely love it, and I can take advantage of that.
If it sounds so simple, why it seems like people around us find it so difficult to actually save and invest? Is it has to do with all the, you know, the media like seduces us to actually, hey, go on vacation, buy these expensive cars, get the latest gadgets?
So apparently this really started in the 1950s, where the generation that came out of the Great Depression, they came out on their feet when, after the Second World War, the economy really started kickstarting again. But what they found was that people weren't spending money and they were saving. They remembered the Depression. And so what companies did in terms of their research was they researched how to get inside the human mind. Their objective really was, how can we manipulate people to convince them that they actually need these products? And so when you look at advertising, what it boils down to in every case is that every ad says one of three things. It says, buy this product and you will be safe. Or it says, buy this product and you will be surrounded by wonderful people of the opposite sex.
That's funny.
Buy this product and you will be happy and you will be surrounded by friends. So it's either safety, friendship and acceptance, or sex. Safety, friendship and acceptance, or sex. And sex is often what they actually target, and we don't even really recognize it, but we are triggered on a subconscious level. If I buy that, we don't really recognize it on the conscious level, but subconsciously that's what the advertisers are actually doing to us.
So you're saying that this is a big conspiracy, yeah?
It's very clever. And like I say, it started in the 50s, and it's very clever. It's a wonderful thing for capitalism. It's how can we actually get people to buy these products? And so they have to actually try to get inside our heads. And it becomes like a drug. Once you start purchasing, once you get sort of down that road towards purchasing things, and especially when you're dealing with instant gratification of credit cards, it becomes a drug. You get used to it. It's really hard to take things away from people. It is. So that's why it's so difficult. People who start down that train of bringing out the credit card and acquiring whatever they want to acquire, that's why it's so difficult for those people to stop. It's stop. You actually have to take something away from them. It's so much better if you actually never go down that path. It is a lot like a drug.
Having a basic financial education, do you think it would be effective to shield us from all those temptations?
I think it would help. I don't think that it would be a foolproof thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think to an extent, there's a hard wiring that takes place too in certain people. Certain people are easier to convince them to, let's say, exercise.
Right.
Certain people are just going to be able to be convinced, and they're actually going to enjoy it more than others.
Like yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same with saving money. Mm-hmm. There's some people that you can actually convince that, hey, delayed gratification is important so that you can have choices further on in life. And then there are the people who just give into it like a drug. And I think financial education would really help. I think if you have fewer people falling into it accidentally, falling into debt accidentally, you know, I think you're always going to get that percentage, no matter what kind of education you give, who just really don't have the discipline.
So if, let's say, I mean, it's a fact that financial education, we don't learn that in school, and unfortunately, we don't have teachers like you. So, I mean, ultimately, I think sometimes this role falls back to the parents themselves, and the parents, if they are not going to teach their kids because they don't have that kind of awareness, so what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, it's a cultural thing too, because money is and has been for a long time a very taboo subject.
Right.
People often talk about their weaknesses as it pertains to money as well, in terms of what a mother and father actually learned that they can pass on to their children from a really young age. So it has to be, culturally, there has to be some kind of shift. And you know what's really kind of interesting and kind of sad at the same time? It often takes some kind of financial calamity for a family to actually be placed into that kind of position where they actually share the finances with the children to explain that, you know, we actually can't afford to take that trip because dad just got laid off. And it's the same too, on a really broader scale, to reading. What fascinates me is reading a lot about the Great Depression and the families that ended up going through. The Grapes of Wrath is just this wonderful book written by John Steinbeck. Have you read it?
No, this particular book, nope.
It's a really old book, but it's a real classic. And you know, the family really comes together, and it often takes a calamity to bring people together. Like 9/11 brought Americans together. You'll find that the tsunami in Japan and the tsunami they ended up facing here in Southeast Asia brought people together. And often that seems to be what it takes. And if we end up with a real financial difficulty where the economic sort of world spins downwards somewhat, we go through a very deep worldwide recession, families will share much more of their personal economic lives because they really have to with their kids. And kids kind of come away stronger because of it.
So unfortunately now we live in an age where we glorify all the, you know, hyper consumption and stuff like that. So kids nowadays, even younger generation like myself, I'm 30 this year by the way, we just don't feel that kind of thing that you just described, yeah?
Right. Yeah, you're right. And you know, it's a tough thing to actually get through because you're hammering up against a culture of spending. But one thing that when I talk to my students, and I teach a personal finance class at Singapore American School. I can't don't drive up in a Ferrari and say, look, I was good with my money, so this is what I have. But I can tell them some stories. Like when I was 30, I took a year off and I traveled. And I had enough money. I really didn't need to work that year. And if I chose to, I wouldn't really have had to go to work for the next two or three. And very few 30-year-olds actually have put themselves in that kind of position. Often, they're behind the eight ball. The old expression, I love the old bumper sticker that said, I owe, I'm off to work, I go.
It's like a slave, yeah? You're a slave to your work, yeah?
Exactly, yeah. And so what I do tell my students is, it feels really good for me to say, at the beginning of a year, am I going to work this year or am I not? Do I feel like taking some time off to travel,
mm-hmm.
To take time off to volunteer? And time is a gift. It really is. And when you have it, it's probably the most wonderful asset there is.
So it's pretty nothing much rocket science, just live within your means, spend less than you earn, avoid bad debt like a plague, and just invest the difference and do what you really are passionate of doing, yeah?
I think so. And you know, it is. It's a very simple concept. It's kind of like, hey, you want a really good diet?
Mm.
I'll tell you what a really good diet is. Drink plenty of water, lots of vegetables, and limit your sugar intake. It's that simple. But it's hard to do. And Buffett says himself, Warren Buffett suggests that investing is simple, but it's not easy for people to do. And I think it's the same when it comes to the discipline of saving, not spending money or too much money on depreciating assets, and rather trying to put your money into appreciating assets.
So, any ex-student of yours that actually came back after a few years and say, hey Andrew, I'm glad I listened to what you taught me in a financial sense, and they say, I'm quite financially well off now. I'm sure you get a lot of these, I mean, students who really appreciate what you taught them in high school, yeah?
I get a lot of that from actually adults, because
wow.
I've been teaching adults financial literacy longer than I've been teaching students financial literacy.
Mm-hmm.
So for years I've been teaching, I was teaching English, high school English, and occasionally I would slip in and talk a little bit about personal finance, but it hasn't been until quite recently that I've been teaching personal finance to high school kids. But for years now I've been teaching adults and putting on seminars, and that's cool. I went to a party tonight, and there was a guy who came up to me and, you know, he had a few beers, and then he just said, I've really got to thank you for this, and went on, and it was kind of neat, you know, and I get that a lot, and it's really rewarding.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, it's just a great feeling when what you do, I mean, what you write, and what you, the financial literacy that you spread around, it literally have an impact in people's life, yeah?
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the great things about the job I do. The teaching profession is really like that too.
Right.
And if you can empower people to be proud and feel really good about who they are and what they've done and what they've accomplished, you can't really get any bigger reward than that. It's a wonderful thing. It's far better than me getting a cash reward.
Andrew, what is your personal view on other investment options apart from index funds, which you are an advocate of? You know, things like rental properties, maybe real estate investment funds?
Yeah, I think rental properties can be great. What I find that's really interesting, though, is generally speaking, there are really good real estate investors and what they do. And then there are the layman and what the layman actually does. And they're actually quite different in terms of what they actually look for and how they value things in properties. Typically what professional real estate investors will do is they will look at the yield on the property. And so they will say, okay, I've just purchased this place and it's whatever, 500,000 ringgit. What is the annual rental income that I can receive from that property? So what is my actual yield on that as a percentage? So is a simple point, let's assume that something is just, it's easy for simplicity's sakes, let's say 100,000 ringgit, and you have a 100,000 ringgit property and you're getting rental of 7,000 ringgit a year. Well, there is a yield of, before expenses and taxes, there's a yield of 7%. This historically is actually pretty average. It's pretty reasonable if you're looking at sort of around a 7% yield on real estate properties. This is what big developers really look for, and that's one of the reasons why they often, instead of going out and buying, really rich people don't run around and buy single family homes. They really want to buy, they might buy apartment blocks or commercial buildings, because in that case they've got one roof to maintain and they got multiple sources of revenue with the tenants. What's really important for them is they don't look at it and buy it to say, I think that property will be worth 2 million ringgit in 5 or 6 years' time. Often they'll look at it and say, how much revenue can be generated from that property? And when it comes to property investing, that's how sophisticated real estate investors invest. What the layman and how the layman actually invests, the regular person, is they often look at what they think that property will be worth one day down the road, and they like to buy what has recently become much more expensive. So I'll give you a really interesting case here in Singapore. We're in this huge real estate bubble. I'm sitting right now in a place, and thankfully, my employer actually pays the rent here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting in a place that will probably be rents right now for about 3,700 Singapore dollars a month.
Mm-hmm.
However, this place is worth, the market value is worth 1.8 million. Now, to purchase a place for 1.8 million and to get revenue of what would amount to, say, $45,000 a year is insane. The yield is probably less than 1%.
Right.
It makes no logical sense whatsoever. So I think what people need to do when they buy property is not to necessarily think about the property as an appreciating asset, but as a revenue generator, and the appreciation becomes the icing on the cake. It's not the cake, it's the icing on the cake.
Do you see yourself diversifying into properties anytime soon?
If the yields were attractive enough, and to be really honest, for me, certainly not in Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now it's absolute insanity.
Right.
It makes really no sense whatsoever. But I'll tell you this, if I lived or my family were based in the United States right now,
mm-hmm.
houses in so many of the US states are going so cheaply. And rental yields are well into double digits in many U.S. states currently. I was just actually reading a blog by a woman named Paula Pant. She's a journalist, and I was reading her blog last night.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a funny thing, because I know the Chinese symbol for danger and opportunity is more or less the same, is it not?
Yes, yes.
And you have the danger with the housing market crash in the United States, but then this woman, Paula, just picked up a house in the U.S. for $20,000.
Okay.
$20,000 for a three-bedroom home. She figures she'll need about $10,000 to actually
rent,
put it to the home itself to get it back up to speed. But it's an unbelievable thing. For $30,000, she's going to be able to buy this house, and rental revenue is going to be, you know, giving her sort of a double-digit yield. So it's fabulous. If that were my hometown, absolutely, I'd be picking up duplexes, quads, not single-family homes. Not if I could help it. Be going for buildings with multiple sources of revenue. Absolutely. So, given the right circumstances, yeah, I'm a little bit like a vulture. I'm always watching. I'm always looking. If I get that kind of opportunity, I'll definitely jump at that.
Yeah, I mean, not a few units, but maybe a few blocks. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Now, Andrew, I read about one of your financial hero, Russ the Mechanic.
Yeah.
You think your financial sense would be any different if you did not meet this guy, Russ the Mechanic, when you were 19?
It's so funny you say that.
Hmm.
I have a feeling if I had not met Russ, I probably would only have 1/4 of the net worth I currently do.
Wow, that's a big difference, yeah?
Yeah, it was just the right time and the right place. So I was young, I was very impressionable, and I was very, very impressed. This guy was so honest with me, and that was one of the things that was just so darn inspiring. He said to me, come on out to my house, and we actually became friends, and he brought out his statements. He brought out his investment statements, and we really chatted about how he ended up building this portfolio. he took me around, and he likes single family homes, and this guy owns a whole slew of family homes in Victoria, British Columbia today, and those homes are worth quite a bit of money. But he took me around and showed me the homes, and he talked me yield, the whole concept of rental yield. And he was a really opinionated guy, very entertaining in this respect, because he really recognized that so many very educated people weren't financially educated. So he was the one who really taught me about real estate yields. And back to your original question, there's no way I'd have anywhere near the money that I have today if it wasn't for me meeting that one guy.
Do you meet Russ after that?
You know, I didn't actually see him for years, but I wrote an article called How I Got Rich on a Middle Class Salary. And I actually ended up writing about him, and I think it was 2005, and it ended up being nominated a finalist for a National Publishing Award in Canada.
Yeah.
And so family members ended up phoning him and saying, Russ, you're in this national magazine. And I hadn't seen him for a really long time. And I ended up going to Victoria. I probably hadn't seen him for at least a decade, at least 10 years. And I just drove up to his house. There he was in the front yard. And he runs into the house and he brings out the magazine. And he was really, really excited. It was fun to actually phone him, because what I did was, when I wrote the book, it was funny because the publisher actually asked me, okay, now, you put this cartoon in the book. Do you have permission for the cartoon? Do you have the license for it? Yes, I have license for all that. Okay, what about this Russ Perry guy? Do you have an actual, you know, do you have word from him that this is okay to have him in the book? And I thought, geez, I don't. So I phoned him, and I said, hey, Russ. And I ended up, and he was really, really happy. He was really proud, and we had this great conversation. And I said to him, I said, do you realize what you did? Because of you, Russ, and this was really cool. It really touched him. I said, because of you, there are hundreds of families in Cambodia right now that have fresh drinking water that never would have had it. And I said, Russ, because of you, there are girls in India who can actually afford to go to school who never would have been able to. And so what happened was Russ inspired me. Russ inspired me, and I was able to amass my wealth. I ended up with really more money than I need. And the operative word there is need. And I was able to look around and see that there were people in this world who really could use some help. And I'm not talking about giving people money and actually weakening them, because that's really what ends up happening. But to give people money so that they can learn to read and write, that strengthens them. To give an organization money that will build wells for fresh water, everybody in this world has the right to fresh water wells. And I think he actually became quite emotional when I told him that indirectly, without you realizing this, you have actually contributed to this by educating me.
That's really a heartwarming story to hear. Yep, it really is.
And my hope too is, and I said this to Russ, I said, I'm teaching this personal finance class now, and part of it is about stewardship. If you amass wealth, one of the great things is, sure, goal one, great, your financial independence, wonderful. But at the same time, stewardship, actually helping other people with your good fortune is important. And so when I said to Russ, think about all of the students that I am now impacting, and the people who they in turn, if I do my job right, will actually be able to help. And I then pointed back to him and said, man, it's amazing how far just one man, or how many people one man can influence.
Really amazing.
Yeah, it's a fun story. Absolutely.
So Andrew, do you plan to retire, or I phrase it in another way, that what is your retirement plan, and what would you imagine yourself doing when you do retire?
Well, right now, I'm just having so much fun just doing the job that I do. I absolutely love it. And I will do that as long as I enjoy it. And here's the beauty of being financially independent, which I am. I have that option. The moment the job doesn't become fun, I move on. I can move on to do another job. I can move on to do volunteer work. I can move on for a while to travel the world. It's great just the options that it actually gives me. So I don't have an actual date where I say, all right, well, that's a point in time where I'm actually going to do nothing. I'll probably always do something. And when I actually do retire, if I do sort of decide not to do any work at all, I'd probably set a goal to do something like an Ironman at age 70 or something crazy and fun.
And you will definitely be in the headline.
80. I won't be the first 70-year-old to do the Ironman. Lots of guys are out there doing that kind of thing, and that's inspirational.
If you ever need one, I mean, let's say you ever need a financial advisor for any reason at all, what are the qualities a millionaire teacher would actually consider?
I think that I would actually look for somebody who I could pay by the hour for advice, rather than look for somebody who takes a portion of what I invest or takes a portion of a percentage of my assets each year. If somebody takes 1% of your assets every year, you are cutting your portfolio's potential in half. At the end of the day, it literally is the difference between, at age 65, between you having 2 million ringgit or 4 million ringgit, when that 1% fee compounds over time. So I think I would be keen to pay, and there are people who do this. They're hard to find. They don't come knocking on your door, but if you do the research, you can often find people who you can pay right up front or by the hour to actually give you financial advice. And two, you know, another thing that I think about, I always wonder about this. This I get a kick out of. You know, when financial planners actually used to come to me, and I'd be at work at the American School, and some guy would come through and he would want to invest my money for me. And he didn't know me, so that was obviously the reason he came to me. He just thought I was a typical guy who didn't know how to invest. And I would say this to them, and this is so telling. I would say this: hey, listen, yeah, that sounds great. So you're a really good advisor, right? You're really good at financial advising. Yes, I'm good at it. I've been doing it for such and such years. I've got this kind of accreditation. Okay, well, tell you what, how about we do this? You bring me 10 years worth of your personal investment statements, and I'll bring you 10 years worth of mine, and we'll compare, and if yours have beaten mine, yeah, I'll invest my money with you.
Oh, that's funny.
Hey, how many of those guys do you think even came back?
I think not.
This many.
Zilch? Zero?
This many would come back. Zero. Now, if the person were a carpenter or a builder, they said, Andrew, I want to build you a house. And I said, okay, show me the houses you built for yourself and or for other people. Absolutely, they would show me. But the odd thing about financial planners or financial advisors, and because people think it's just too rude to ask, nobody asks the most important question of all. Let me see how you are with your money. Are you wasting money? Do you own a load of depreciating assets? Do you have a load of credit card debt? I would love to do audits on these guys. It would actually be great. Let's see your credit rating. If they can't do it for them, are they going to be able to do it for you?
Yeah. I mean, you got to talk the talk and walk the walk, right? Obviously, if you are not someone who walk the walk, then they approach the wrong guy, I would say. Absolutely. So I stress this again, zero comes back to you. Zero. None of them.
I've done this a number of times. In fact, there was a period of time where I would almost look for these guys. If I knew they were around, I would put myself in their pathway. I would literally put myself in their pathway for just the sheer entertainment of it all.
That's really funny. I mean, if it weren't for the podcast, I would be laughing my ass off now. Andrew, it's really a great pleasure talking to you. You are such an inspiration. You are very passionate in what you do, and the wisdom that in this short conversation is really, really inspiring.
Oh, thank you.
Andrew, thank you so much for your time. But before that, let me ask you, is there a plan for you to come up with a sequel for your book, given the success of your first book?
Well, the publisher does want that. And they contacted me today they contacted me fairly regularly and asked me that question. Because this book ended up becoming an international bestseller. So it really surprised me. If I do a sequel, what I think I would like to do is target it for kids, specifically for kids, and actually have some fun with it. Actually write it in a voice that is even less academic than the voice I've written in for Millionaire Teacher, and really have a lot of fun with just the language and the analogies. And something that I think, my hope is something that a 14-year-old or 13-year-old could pick up, actually find entertaining, and learn from. So that would be an eventual goal, I think.
I believe it would be more entertaining than your first book, because your book is really, really entertaining.
If you read the kids one, I can do better. It'll be a lot of fun.
I'm personally looking forward for that.
Yeah.
Are you doing any traveling?
We're heading to Sri Lanka in about a week and a half.
Wow, great.
And we love to travel. So my wife and I we're lucky as school teachers, because we do get about 13 weeks off a year. And so that in itself just gives us wonderful opportunities to travel and to see different parts of... We love Southeast Asia. We just love it.
Andrew, perhaps I cram in one more short question, as in, what are the top three things you would happily spend on nowadays?
Definitely travel. My big weakness is massages. My wife and I have a woman who comes to our house every single week, and she gives us fabulous massages. And so we have our own massage table, and my wife and I are just addicted to it. We absolutely love it. So the traveling, the massaging, and then just the eating really good food. We just absolutely love that.
So you love Singapore?
Yeah, we do. We really enjoy Singapore.
Any plan to come visit Penang?
You know, I've never actually been there. But,
yeah.
But I do love Malaysia. You know, one of my favorite places is Pulau Timaman. Have you been there?
Nope.
But yes. At some point, we're gonna have to get over to Penang, because I hear it's actually really cool.
Oh yeah, I mean, you should give me a shout. Perhaps if you are coming to Penang, and I'm more than happy to show you around.
Yeah, maybe I have a place to stay, then I don't have to pay rent, right?
Oh yes, like I read in your book where you look after people's house during winter, and you don't have to pay rent, right?
Millionaire Teacher, right?
Exactly.
You stay with me, I stay with you, neither of us has to pay for a hotel, right?
Great idea, Andrew. Great idea. Okay, Andrew, wow, it's really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
And have a safe trip to Sri Lanka.
Thank you so much, and good luck with your blogging. Great stuff. Well, hey, thanks so much. I enjoyed actually chatting with you.
Hey, thanks. Thanks a lot, Andrew. Thanks a lot.
Welcome.
Okay.
Have a good night.
You too. See ya.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.